I'm Tom Hoos from Earlton, New York, and I'm listening to WGXC Acra, New York.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep the looking becoming air of WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves or music from around the world and around your corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at WGXC.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment.
Hello, folks. You're listening to the Mad Dog, Matt Wilson, and you're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM.
Become a sustaining supporter
today. WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Green, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971.
Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
To turn your audio-visual how-do-eyes into here's how you can.
Generous ongoing
visit
support
dedicatedpresentation.com or call 845-475-8465 for more information.
Listeners.
Dedicated Presentation Solutions,
community radio,
your
and their
audio
investment
visual
helps
partner.
To sustain WGXC as a
WGXC
public platform
is made
for information,
in part,
experimentation,
by the generous
and engagement
ongoing support
in Green
of the Bridge
Columbia
Street
counties.
Theater.
You
Catskill,
too can become
York.
A sustaining supporter by going to
WGXC.org
are among the station's most dedicated donors
and designating
they care
an
deeply
amount
about
of
creative
your choosing.
Community radio.
Thank you.
And their
for
investment
your support.
Helps to sustain WGXC as a public
we interrupt
platform.
Interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station. Stand by for news.
Direct via
you
satellite from our on the spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is Daily News and Weather Report.
Designating an amount
of your choosing. From the WGXC newsroom.
Thank
this
you
is
for
the
your
WGXC
support.
Hands-on Radio News Update.
You are listening to 90.7 FM, WGXC, the local hangout of the airwaves, Green and Columbia counties.
William J. Kemble is reporting for the Daily Freeman.
Good evening,
the
comrades,
Board of Education
and
has hired
welcome
an attorney
to the
to review the
May 2021 edition
grade English
of Poet Radio. My name
stated
is
George
Chris,
Floyd did not
and
die
the
because he was killed
guest on the show tonight is Sharon Mesmer. Sharon is originally from
Board
Chicago.
May 25th approved
she's
hiring
a writer
Brock
of poetry, fiction, and essays who has published numerous books
Brock
and whose work has appeared in the New York Times, Paris Review, American Poetry Review, and Brooklyn Rail. She also teaches and currently holds a position at NYU. I've known Sharon since the early 90s when we met through an Allen Ginsberg course I sat in on at Brooklyn College. I knew her as a member of the Unbearables Collective. And then as a central figure in the FLARF, quote-unquote, movement, where she created incredibly entertaining poems using Google search results. She's moved on from that mode, and we'll be focusing on her newest works today, in particular the manuscript Even Living Makes Me Die. Sharon has a very nice website where you can delve into her various activities, and Saugerty's she also has a page featuring
Reinhardt
recordings of her work
May 11th
at Penn
letter.
Sound.
Reinhardt later
Sharon, it's great to have you on the program. Thanks for joining me tonight. Now, in the introduction, I didn't say too much about your new writing, but I was hoping we could start with that and maybe we could talk a little bit about
Nick Reisman is reporting for State of Politics. The tenants and landlords financially affected by the COVID-19 pandemic will have access to billions of dollars in aid from the state of New York under a program announced May 25th by Governor Andrew M. Cuomo.
Manuscript,
money includes $2.7 billion in energy rental assistance for state residents who have demonstrated a financial impact due to the pandemic. Applications will be accepted starting Tuesday, June 1st. The program, to be administered by the Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance, is expected to help between 170,000 and 200,000 households. The program will initially prioritize unemployed tenants as well as low-income households.
It started
small
when
businesses
I was
will also have access
AWP
to $800 million
in
recovery funds.
And
those
I
applications will
breakdown.
Be accepted
and
beginning
AWP
Thursday,
really
June 10th. Grant for that program will range from $5,000 to $50,000 based on annual gross receipts for 2019.
And
New York lost an estimated 2 million jobs during the 2020 shutdown, which was imposed to limit the spread of coronavirus. But the economy continues to struggle in returning to normal with an unemployment rate in April of 8.2%, higher than the national average. During the past month, landlords and state lawmakers had urged the state to set up an assistance program amid the ongoing eviction moratorium and mounting financial pressures. Cuomo said, and I quote,
Natalie
the
Garius.
Critical funding will help
and
ensure
said, well,
New Yorkers
maybe you'd be
who
interested
are
in this
experiencing
book,
financial hardship through no fault of their
the
own
Fire's
will
Journey
not be thrown out
Odio.
Into the streets
and I opened
while
it up
also providing stability
I
for small businesses so they can help play a role in New York's economic resurgence.
And the strangeness
you can
and
read
the
full story
the
at NewYorkStateOfPolitics.com.
I said to Natalie, I said, oh, what is this? And she said, yeah, Eunice Odio. She was really amazing. She was dead for 3 days before anybody
being
knew.
Further delayed as members of the Hudson Housing Authority
and,
now say
she's
that
had
local contractors are overwhelmed with
other
projects
before,
as the pandemic
but this is the
recedes.
First time
quote, there
that
are
her
so many amazing local businesses that are doing construction
epic
work, but they're all
is being
so busy, unquote,
published. And I said, 400-page epic.
Executive Director Tim
and
Mattis
then
agreed,
I took a look
quote,
at Eunice Odio's face, and,
unquote,
you know, I was just
they
so drawn in. She has
quote,
the,
in
she
advance,
had this
unquote.
Incredible,
also, the
powerful
Housing Authority
movie star-looking face, and I was just completely drawn in by her, and then by her story. She was born in Costa Rica. She could not get a toehold in a literary scene there, so she went to Mexico. She kind of ran afoul of the literary scene there because she was
a
difficult person. She also lived in different countries. She had different jobs in different places. And she lived in New York City for a while. But in
the
50s, she started this project called The Fire's Journey. Which is this epic. It's a feminist epic, even though she would never consider herself
Andrea
a feminist.
Andrea Macko is reporting
and
for Porcupine
so
Soup. Officials at the
like
Olana
feminism.
State
she didn't
Historic
like the
Site and Columbia Green Community College announced
like
this
York,
week they would collaborate to provide workforce development opportunities for students enrolled in the college's business,
strange,
art, and environmental science
like
classes, and for those
an
interested in gaining work experience related
the
to their course of study. A new collaborative three-semester program beginning in the fall of 2021 will provide an opportunity
for
Olana to connect and collaborate with Columbia Green faculty and students throughout the academic year. Dr. Carly Drummer, president of Columbia Green Community College, noted, and I quote, "This partnership is the first of its kind in the state and possibly the nation. To offer students an array of learning and career opportunities intersecting the arts, business, environmental studies, marketing, and management of a nonprofit arts-based organization." End quote. Students will be invited to engage with Olana year-round through class visits with Olana staff during the fall semester, a corresponding honors project during the spring, and paid internship and or employment experience in the summer. Amy Hossman, director of Olana State Historic Site, said, and I quote, "As
a
New York historic site, Olana
Alfonsina Storni and Alejandra Pizarnik, you know, died by suicide. So did Violeta Parra. And if the women who didn't die by suicide were underknown and neglected. And since I was going through my own neurological event at that time, I was, of course, attracted to these women who were writing from and through you know, they're suffering. And I started reading their work, and it just inspired me to write. And over, I would say, like, the 2 years after I wrote that article for American Poetry Review, I started amassing a lot of poems about and for and after these women. So I just started putting together a collection, and the phrase "even living makes me die" kind of jumped out at me. It was something that I found in one of Delmira Agostini's poems. And Delmira Agostini lived in the 19th century, and she wrote in Uruguay, and she wrote really frankly about her depression, her anxiety, sexuality. And she died in a double murder-suicide with her ex-husband, with whom she had reunited. And they were meeting in a hotel room, and he killed her and killed himself. So not very happy subject matter, but the work is incredibly powerful and beautiful for all of these women. And you and I were talking about Violeta Parra.
Right.
Alan had introduced me to the work of her brother, Nicanor Parra, but he had never told me about her. And I found out about her through my research. And she was mainly a musician, you know, and I was really drawn to her, to the lyrics to her song, Gracias a la Vida, which she wrote not too long before she died. And she also had, I think, the first one-woman show at the Louvre of her arpilleras, which are tapestries. And, you know, I did research on her. I watched a movie about her, and I was, of course, drawn to her story, the way she lived her life, which was very uncompromising. She created a performance space outside of Santiago in Chile called the Queen's Tent. You know, she was a promoter of folkloric, what we would call folkloric dancing and music. And it was kind of a little too far away from the center of the city. And she didn't get the kind of audiences she wanted to get. And she killed herself in the performance space.
Oh. Lord.
So the stories are really incredible, and they're horrible because these women were so brilliantly talented. And I felt like because I had survived, I wanted to do something for them. I wanted to somehow recognize them or honor them. So I wrote these poems about them, and I decided that I would gather them into an anthology, and I would also have a page of biography for each woman and, you know, a suggested reading list, because a lot of their stuff is not available in English. But, you know, if you have a good translator or you know Spanish, you know, you can get a hold of it and you can read it. Not all of the women are from Spanish-speaking places. There are women from our country, from Canada, and three of the women were women I knew. One of them is still alive. I was just really drawn to her work, and she's underknown. And two of them were my friends, who one of them, like Eunice Odio, was dead for 3 days before anyone knew in Arizona, and the other one died of a heroin overdose.
Lori Jackson?
That was Lori Jackson. Right. And the previous person I mentioned was Lydia Tomku. And yeah, so that's the project.
It sounds like excellent research, Sharon. I was looking. Yeah, well, that's that's what makes it worthwhile on some level. I was looking at the manuscript, and I noticed that there was maybe 20 to 25% of the writers who I was familiar with. So one thing that your poems here are doing is, you know, it's bringing attention and exposure to these writers, which I think is fantastic.
I would love to do that. Yeah.
Well, why don't we go from that excellent introduction to the work to hearing some of the poems?
Okay. We were just talking about Lori Jackson. She was a poet that I knew from the Chicago poetry scene. She died in 1990, and the poem that I wrote for her is called Privates of the Popular Apocalypse. That's a line from one of her poems. So, Privates of the Popular Apocalypse after Lori Jackson, U.S. 1962 to 1990. I didn't die young enough. But I am coiffed and wired on broken linoleum, your finger seating me like dragon teeth, my clavicle bruised in freight yard dusk, a parenthesis of grease on the ceiling of the Y. So what if it's true? The clavicle is the body's only long horizontal bone. And the stuff a young girl does to make a man a hero cuts a low, keening moan amid the moon and ablutions. But hey, weren't we discussing linoleum, the ceiling of the Y, bald, bright July? And would it hurt to fall asleep as the coach house smolders, my face all twisted, but recognizably me? Should I keep going? I am now looking for the poem that I wrote to Elise Cohen, who would be a familiar name to you. She was a friend of Allen Ginsberg. She's mostly known as being Allen's last straight relationship, which is unfortunate because she was a really talented and brilliant poet herself. She died in, oh, that's so odd. She died in 1962, and that was the year that Laurie Jackson was born. So that's an odd little confluence right here. She wrote a lot, actually, and after she died by jumping out a window, her parents tried to burn or otherwise destroy her work, but it was saved by a friend of hers. And it was published in a collection by Tony Triglio a few years ago, which is where I read it. Although Alan was always telling me about her and saying, oh, it's such a shame that you can't read her work. Well, then I did read it and I loved it. So this is called Given to Fire, after Elise Cohen, U.S., 1933 to 1962. Not from nowhere, not the consort of a river. What I remembered best were accidents of quiet brightness, Alan's arms around me. And if he said I was standing in the middle of the room at dawn, all in black, high on mescaline, more beautiful than the poem, then I was. And now I am passing back into the rocks, into the God of rocks. Betty said it was birds who first fitted witches with wings, while fir trees of great antiquity sang lays they'd learned from their mother air. I say it was too easy to love the leggy one who made me run up and down the Statue of Liberty until I learned to fly, past the frosted skylight air shaft, through the closed window, like an arrow cast without a bow, without an owner, but born on longing, a cool stream of air. Okay, so...
great image there with the running up and down the Statue of Liberty until I learned to fly.
Well, I think Alan actually made her do that. Not until she learned to fly, but there was something that I read where she did run up and down the stairs inside the Statue of Liberty. I'm blaming it on Alan, but I should really get my research correct.
Still a great image. I mean, we could all use a bit of that, like everyone.
Yes. With social distancing.
Yeah.
So this is a poem after Julia de Burgos, Puerto Rico, 1917 to 1953, who actually died on the streets of New York. And this poem is called To Sharon Mesmer. This poem was not written by you, Sharon Mesmer, white woman whose name means complainer of insomnia. This poem was written by me, Julia de Burgos, whose name means my eyes are filled with the graves of stars, and that's why I can't fly. Who am I? Don't you know me? Well, when God asked me who I wanted to be, and I said, someone who loves peacefully, God wrote down amnesiac and pushed me out of baby heaven like a blank pushes a blank out of a blank. Fill in the blanks, Sharon Mesmer. I've already done all the work. What, you're still wondering how I got inside? Still wondering why only one of us can fly? Well, keep in mind that when you write a line like, "No one loved me, but I had wings," we both know you're trying to sound like Mary Oliver. I know, because I never tried to write myself into a position involving career advancement or even happiness. I am no mere witness to inertia. I know that heaven kills and hell transforms a witness to inertia into an embodied form of joy for all eternity. At the same time, I'm no angel. I'm not even a filthy pigeon. What am I then? I am the scaled fish writhing, still alive in your hands, my wild eyes pleading with you to blank. You know what to do. Start with feeling the constrictions of those sticky wings. It was interesting that I picked that because it had the lines about flying, and it's kind of odd. In fact, now I know what I'm going to read next, because the next poem I'm going to read has the line that I quoted in that poem. So I will read that. This is Wings after Delmira Agustini, Uruguay, 1886 to 1914. Alas, Dolores, my mouth once smelled of burnt coffee and cigarettes. Garlic juice oozed from under my nails. I had no teeth, no hair. No one loved me, but I had wings. My cat, Azure Vivian, was also old. Her fur was matted, her eyes were clouded, her chest feathered with dust. She could barely walk, but she had wings as well. Each wing was a world, a universe not yet known. At night we flew by starlight, over long grass waving, over cathedrals hewn from steep cliff faces. In the mornings, only we knew. Then I fell in love with lethargy. Alas, Dolores, I fell in love with watching TV in the kitchen. In the cool, dark afternoons, the TV became a saint, robed in local clothes. I thought the kitchen was deliverance, but it was just a room stinking of burnt coffee and cigarettes, where roaches made their quiet homes behind dishes and piles of clothes and mail. I let forgetfulness lull me, soothe me. I dwelled all day at the table, the TV in front of me. All day and into night I watched. There were so many shows. Asleep, I dreamed of watching. Soon my wings grew small, Azure Vivian's too. All day and into night I tried to stay them with my hands. For months I tried to stay them. And then I couldn't fit my fingers into the spaces where they had disappeared. Then Azure Vivian disappeared too, the old cat, the only one who knew. One day I awoke, alone. Alas, Dolores, I was angry because no one could see my wings. They were strong as raven's claws. Azure Vivian knew, and now she's gone too. I'm alone in the kitchen, watching television, but content just knowing that Azure Vivian and I could fly.
My cat walked through the room while you were reading that one.
Of course.
The old cat with the matted
hair. Of course.
Yeah, it's one of those connections.
Exactly.
Speaking of connections, let me jump in here and talk. Let's talk about the connection between these poets and your poems a little more, because the poems seem to include details from these writers, female writers' lives. And I think in the introduction, you say something like you found your language blurring into theirs, and you were sort of speaking after their style. I was wondering if you could say a bit more about that, because I'm not in, you know, the Sharon Mesmer that I'm used to hearing, say, over the past 10, 15 years, is I really only heard that voice in the De Burgos, the After De Burgos poem,
right,
a little bit. So maybe you can say a little bit about, you know, how you're channeling here.
Well, you know, the other me, you know, I really could not deploy that kind of voice with this because I thought it would be disrespectful.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it would be perhaps like I was making fun of these writers. But the reason that I did that with the De Burgos poem is I'm going to try to find the poem right now that I wrote that one from, and you'll see why I use that poem. It should be right here in this anthology. But, yeah, I thought it would be a little, it would just be disrespectful, you know, because most of these women were not funny. But I will read you the Julia de Burgos poem that that one comes from. And it's called To Julia de Burgos. So that's why mine is to Sharon Mesmer. To Julia de Burgos, the people are saying that I am your enemy, that in poetry I gave you to the world. They lie, Julia de Burgos. They lie, Julia de Burgos. The voice that rises in my verses is not your voice. It is my voice. For you are the clothing and I am the essence. Between us lies the deepest abyss. You are the bloodless doll of social lies, and I the virile spark of human truth. You are the honey of courtly hypocrisy, not I. I bear my heart in all my poems. You, like your world, are selfish, not I. I gamble everything to be what I am. You are only the serious lady, Signora, Doña Julia. Not I. I am life. I am strength. I am woman. You belong to your husband, your master, not I. I belong to nobody or to all. For to all, I give myself in my pure feelings and thoughts. You curl your hair and paint your face, not I. I am curled by the wind, painted by the sun. You are the lady of the house, resigned, submissive, tied to the bigotry of men, not I. I am Rocinante, bolting free, wildly, snuffling the horizons of the justice of God. That was translated by Grace Shulman. That's a great poem. Mine is not as ballsy as that poem, but, you know.
Yours might be a little funnier. I mean.
Hers is pretty funny in a way, but it's also horribly sad at the same time. Her poems are great.
That's one of the authors I know nothing about, actually.
Yeah. I didn't know that much about her until I started this project. But if you bring her name up to Puerto Rican poets, oh, yes, Julia de Burgos, right.
But she's not the one who died on the streets of New York.
Yes, she did. Yes,
what was
she
that
did.
About?
I think, well, you know, I'll read you the introduction. It's only a paragraph long in this Stephen Tapscott anthology. He edited it. The oldest of seven children, Julia de Burgos was raised in rural Puerto Rico. She married early and, after a difficult divorce, left Puerto Rico to pursue a doctorate in Cuba. In her poems, however, she retained an affection for the landscape of her native Carolina region, the valley of the Luisa Valley, southeast of San Juan. I probably mispronounced that, I'm sorry. As a locus of innocence and relief, a pastoral alternative to social injustice, urban poverty, and the personal turmoil of her adult life. She died in New York City in 1953 and was buried in a pauper's anonymous grave. Several years later, her body was returned with honors to Puerto Rico. Her sister Consuelo edited and published her posthumous collection, El Mar y Tú, The Sea and You, in 1954. At the time of her death, Burgos had published two major books of poems, Poemas en Veinte Surcos, Poems in 20 Furrows, 1940, I pronounced that incorrectly, and Canción de la Verdad Sencilla, Song of the Simple Truth, 1940. Yeah.
Well, it's great to hear you reading the poems, Sharon, and I'm hoping you would kind of, at this point, can we hear some more of your work?
Sure. I will read a poem. I mean, you were talking about how was I channeling these people. Some of them it was difficult, but with this one poet, with two poets, with the Elise Cohen poem, I really felt that she was there. And that, in a way, she was sort of telling me what to write about. I know that sounds like so woo-woo, but that, you know, and I don't want to get into that. But I really did feel that when I was writing the poem for her and reading about her and looking at her pictures. Another poet that this occurred with was Marcia Nardi. Now, her actual name was Lillian Massel. She called herself Marcia Nardi. You might feel that she's a little bit familiar. It's because she had a correspondence with William Carlos Williams, and he used her. He actually used lines from her work to create the Kress figure from Patterson.
No, I didn't know. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I wrote a poem for her, and I, you know, showed it to my, you know, poetry group, and it was like it did not get a great reception. So I thought, I'll just put this away. So I put it away, but I kept having these feelings like I needed to pick it up, I needed to redo it, I needed to, like, read her letters, because the way that I did the research on her was I read a volume of the letters that she exchanged with William Carlos Williams. I cannot remember the name of the woman who put this together, and I'm really sorry, but if you want, I can tell you later. You know, I read those letters again, and I redid the poem, and I really felt like she was nagging me. I mean, literally nagging me to work on the poem again. She was a very insistent person. She had a very difficult life. She raised a son. She was always needing, she was in desperate need of money all the time. She was always asking Williams to help her with money, to help her get published. She had a book come out from New Directions. They advanced her some money, but she was always in dire straits. So I kind of feel like her insistence was also like working within me to get me to finish this poem for her. So this is the poem I wrote for her, and it's called Interlocutor. After Marcia Nardi, Lillian Massel, U.S., 1900 to 1990. The he in this poem, by the way, is Williams. He told me some lives are fated to perish. He said I was one of those lives. He said I spoke of nothing save my problems. But I know what I'm about. I know the stem that bears no blossom must be for some the blossom, the host, not of something never to be born, but of something already whole, even though unborn. It is fitting then this sunless run of 50 years, natural as chaos, as waste, as the stationary mayhem of losing a baby twice. But one loses nothing. One is, in fact, free of dull similitudes and useless feminine gestures. One retains the right to not be beautiful, to be positively ugly, and still have value. A dark arcade of the Middle Age. All these distressed concerns of mine, all this mischancing of plans, just a funny carnival wonder trail. He fused my words with his and became famous. But not through carelessness or lack of gratitude, rather a gnosis of not knowing, a gift.
So the interlocutor, that's kind of an interesting title for a poem, given the way that you're producing these poems, right? I mean, that's you're sort of a type of interlocutor.
Well, I don't want to be speaking for them. I mean, that's why instead of like the poems being, you know, like to Marcia Nardi or for, you know, they're after, because I'm coming after them. You know, I'm not speaking for them. I am speaking to them in a way, but I'm really, you know, speaking after them. I don't want to contain them in a way. I'm just sort of presenting them, you know.
But it's kind of a mixture of her details and your details. Am I right?
Yeah. I mean, there are no details from my life in most of these poems, but there are my opinions,
right?
You know, about the women's lives. So actually, I'm working on a poem right now for a woman named Mary McLean. And I am sort of blending my life with hers, because I think of all the women in this collection, and I actually say this in my poem for her. I actually say this in my poem for her, that of all the women in the collection, she would understand my doing that, even though we would probably never get along in real life. She was an interesting character. She wrote a work called The Diary of Mary MacLane, and it became a sensation at the turn of the century. And it really is sort of like the first instance of possibly creative nonfiction. It's just about her. She was 19 when she wrote it. She might have been 20 when it was published. And she just became this, you know, like youthful girl sensation. And she did readings, and she was very outrageous and really cool. And she even made a movie called, what was the movie called? Like something like All the Men Who've Made Love to Me. But it doesn't exist anymore. There's no print of it.
And then what era, when did Mary MacLane live?
She died.
I mean, just to put it in the context, because I'm...
Yeah, she was born 1881 to 1929.
Oh, wow.
Wait, that's not right. No, that is right.
So way before like Sylvia Plath or
totally.
Like that.
And I don't even know if any of these women had ever even heard of her. The reason that I heard of her was because just by chance, I picked up this book called In the Realms of the Unreal, quote unquote, insane writings. And it's the writings of people who were in insane asylums. She was never, I don't even really know how she got into this anthology, to be honest. It's the anthologist was John Oakes, and it was published by Four Walls, Eight Windows in the 90s. I should really read his note again. I think it's because she became a recluse. She was born in Winnipeg, and then the family moved to Butte, Montana, which she hated. And she had this whirlwind life, and she, you know, moved back to Montana and died there, and she was very unhappy. And the odd thing was I picked up this book and started reading it again on May 2nd, which is her birthday. I had no idea. She was born May 2nd, 1881, and she would have been 140 years old. And, you know, on the day that I started this poem, which is a weird coincidence.
Cool. Well, she made a film in the 1920s. It's not really a surprise that it doesn't exist, right? I mean,
it's not a surprise it doesn't exist. I should really find what that movie, it was called like To All the Men Who've Made Love to Me, or The Men Who've Made Love to Me, something like that.
It'd be really interesting to see it, right?
It would
100
be great.
Years later or something. What that?
Yeah,
meant.
It would be great. There are stills from it. You can see stills, but the film is gone.
You know, Sharon, you mentioned something sort of in passing that I wanted to follow up on, and that is you said you were looking at pictures of these writers, and I was wondering just how much, like, getting a sense of how they looked or presented themselves in the photographs, does that work into the, you know, your sense of, you know, what comes out in the poems?
The reason that I started doing that was because I just wanted to look in their eyes.
Wow.
You know, I mean, they're not all looking at, you know, in the camera. It's not monolithic, you know, but I just wanted to just look in their eyes and get a feeling for, you know, like a gesture from them, like how they might have looked. I don't mean how they might have looked facially. I mean how they might have turned their eyes, you know, how they might have looked at something. So what I started doing was the women, and most of them, even Delmira Agostini, you know, when did she die? Delmira Agostini died, I just read the poem for her. She died in 1914. So there are pictures of her. So what I did was when I would research these women, I would go, you know, I would like look online for their photographs. and I would cut the photograph out and I would paste it in their section of this 20th century Latin American poetry anthology, the Stephen Tapscott anthology. I would actually paste or tape or both sometimes the photos in there, like in their section, so that when I read them, I could be looking at them.
I think that's a really good idea, and I can see how that would maybe build a type of arc or energy.
Yeah. Some of them, I mean, even like, well, the women who aren't in here, like Marcia Nardi, Lori Jackson, Elizabeth Smart. I'm trying to think, Gwen McEwen was another Canadian poet. My friend Lydia Tomcue. It's not that difficult to come by pictures of them. So when I was using their books, I would also put their picture in their book. So that, although with Lydia and Lori, I knew what they looked like, so I didn't need their pictures.
Feel like reading a couple more or so poems?
Sure. Speaking of Canadian poems, actually, I should read the Violeta Parra poem because of our conversation about Alan and her brother Nicanor. So this is, My Supper Once Had a Song Inside, after Violeta Parra, Chile, 1917 to 1967, with a last line by Hakuin. My supper once had a song inside. The song was the world before the sweet gum trees. The trees were hidden inside the earth inside an alphabet. My meat was sweet gum and maple rain. The maple rain, the alphabet inside the earth. The earth, an ancient lamp still burning in an urn. The urn, a moon of corn, a fleet of deer. I never wondered, will there always be a song inside supper? Was there always a place like this? A place with a sweet gum tree at the beginning of everything, a moon of corn, and a fleet of deer? We were all small animals then, our suppers the meat of sweet gum. To grow tall, we were told to bind rain with stones, to burn sweet gum to ash for a spell, to become lush, elemental, with frank allure, to think only of days to come, to think only of growing, to forget an alphabet. Now my supper is rain on the windowsills, my meat an alphabet of wet cement. A fleet of bikes crashes past the gas station. I feel my way toward them with my tongue. And I wonder, is there still a song inside supper, still a world burning in an urn? If there is still an alphabet, there must be an earth and sweet gum meat inside the coal and ash.
Wow.
That's a song because she wrote songs.
Hmm. I'm guessing that she must have been older than her brother.
I think so, yeah. Yes, I am almost positive she was.
So the style is so different.
If you have a chance, there's a movie on YouTube about her that was based on her son's book. It's called Violeta Went to Heaven. And also all her music, you can hear on YouTube, especially Gracias a la Vida. I mean, that's an iconic song, maybe not here, but Joan Baez recorded a version of it, a cover of it, not a version of it, a cover of it. It's beautiful. And Violeta Parra, it's just voice and guitar when she sings it. And it's so moving.
I'll definitely take a listen and a look at that. What's that, the line, my meat is an alphabet of wet cement?
I mean, where did I have that?
I mean, it's funny because even now I know that it's Sharon Mesmer reading the poems, I almost feel like...
Oh, I found it.
I feel like... it's this author, and I'm reading this author's poem, and I don't know why that is, but I'm getting.
Well, that would be great if you get that impression. That would be
no,
amazing.
I wouldn't have said it if I wasn't getting. I was like, well, that was the line of Violeta's, not Sharon's.
But no, that The line is, now my supper is rain on the windowsills, my meat an alphabet of wet cement.
That's great.
Well, thank you. That's not, I don't think, but I mean, if you take a look at the English translation of the lyrics to Gracias a la Vida, there, it's very juxtaposed and interesting what she is thankful for. I'm trying to see, I don't have the lyrics here. Maybe I should try to find them while you talk.
No, that's okay. I mean, I know, I think you may have even at one point sent me the link to the movie and the songs.
Maybe.
I have to look at that. It has been very recently, though. I haven't checked it out yet. I am hoping to hear some more poems, but let me ask, I mean, this is sort of an inevitable question I feel like I have to ask, but these, the style of these poems are so different. It's such a drastic moving away from like the Flarf mentality. And you may be wanting to do that desperately, but maybe you can talk about the shift in the style and approach here.
I've actually written those Flarfy poems. Like, if you want me to read one, I could read you one that I wrote about quarantine. I mean, when quarantine first started, it was just so, like, scary and depressing and, you know, unprecedented that I actually did write some Flarf poems. If you want to hear one, I could read you one. But yeah, I just...
I mean, I love Sharon Mesmer as a Flarfist, but also this is amazing, the new work. I wasn't trying to lead you into that. Maybe we'll get there. We have a few more minutes. But
yeah.
So this project, as you said, started before the COVID pandemic.
Oh, it started in... well, I mean, I started...
2013 or something.
Yeah, 2013. But then it really got going in about 2016.
And you're trying to get the book published now, or it has some...
Yes, it's not done yet. At some point, yes, I will be wanting to send it out, yeah. I mean, I have sent it out to one place, and I haven't heard back yet, so maybe I shouldn't say anything.
That's fine. But was it a conscious decision to sort of move in another direction, or it just happened that way?
Well, I'm also, you know, I'm also writing other kinds of poems. I also took advantage, if you could say, of the quarantine to finish this long hybrid prose poem memoir about my sister, my adopted sister, who died in 2009. And my adopted sister was American Indian and Mexican. So she and her life and my feelings about her definitely filter into this manuscript. So mm-hmm. I don't think it was a coincidence. She died of cirrhosis, and she had a very, very difficult life. And I don't think it was a coincidence that I finished both of them. Right. The longer book about my sister, I started after she died in 2010. And then when I had this mental breakdown, I couldn't look at it again. And I didn't pick it up for maybe about 7 or 8 years. And I picked it up and I, you know, started finishing it. But then when we all went in lockdown, I thought, well, I have to finish it now, you know. So then that's exactly when I finished it.
Hmm. I noticed there are many of these poems in the manuscript, the Even Living Makes Me mm-hmm. Die, are prose poems. You haven't read you haven't read any of them yet, but so there's different styles within it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you're writes stories, and you're in the class you're teaching in creative nonfiction. So you're very involved with like language vertically and horizontally, so to speak. Right. And there's a difference there. And I mean, you don't have to talk about that, but I notice it.
Well, the prose poems in Even Living are prose poems because that's what that's the style that particular woman wrote in. Like Alejandra Pizarnik, you know, she had some of her books have come out from Ugly Duckling recently.
I know Cole Heinowitz translated
yes,
her work.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
I was hoping you might read that one if you're taking requests.
I will read that one.
I mean,
I have it right here.
You were talking about how the Americans don't get so much poems in translation, and I could think of that example for sure.
Yeah, no, those are beautiful translations. So this is, actually, this poem is going to be coming out soon in a magazine called On the Seawall. So this is called Caryatis, after Alejandra Pizarnik, Argentina, 1936 to 1972, with a phrase by Basho. That's so funny, because the last poem had the Hakuin, and this has a phrase by Basho. It's the first phrase in the poem. Clouds are sailing slowly westward as if in pilgrimage. Like the planets, they are travelers, familiars of an injurious sun. Bird bones frame the door of the cottage where girls about to be crushed by stones await the sacrifice of their sour clothes. I wait too, like someone many lifetimes ago, already dead at the beginning of everything. The healer who cannot die and so heals all waves me in. I port ahead through bluish vapors of eucalyptus. I knock and ask, is it true that certain words may restore a forgotten spell? He answers, here a church was raised up in the rain. And so I cross the threshold. Inside, a girl is attempting to lift a stone that has already crushed her. Even a corpse is a site of continual epiphany, he says. I listen for the sake of listening, in light of the absence of light. How quiet it is. Minutes pass and become days. Instruction is given in images. My mother and I bathing together in a tub we filled with our blood. There was sunlight on the other side of a frosted window, and waving shadows of green reticulate vessels of leaves. Ours, the life which lives by dying. By dint of divination, I find coherence in scattered circumstance, in dying of work too heavy for a girl. A girl abandoned, perhaps, but also chosen. To survive is to defy, the healer says. Trade your strange light for a body. My arms are strong from lifting, I say, but I am tired of being honed by spit. After a stellium of nostalgia, the stone is loosened. I walk out knowing I will no doubt drift away or list into a river. Any small stirring of water must now shepherd my breath.
The Caryatis, that's something Greek.
Well, a caryatid is the sculpture usually of a woman that holds up an arch, part of an arch on a building. Yeah, like.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah. And Caryatis, there's a lot of different meanings, but that was also, she was a nymph who was in the retinue of Diana, I think. So that poem is about, you know, healing, sickness and healing, I would say. But Cole Heinowitz's translations are so gorgeous. They really are beautiful. I was really inspired by them.
Oh, good. That's good. I'm sure she'd be... We'd be glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this poem is taking, still absorbing it, right? I'm trying to...
Yeah, it's a kind of an opaque... Some of Pizarnik's work was opaque. And, you know, not all of her work was prose poems, but the prose poems were a little opaque. And so I tried to kind of bring that in.
Right, right. Well, it seems righteous, you know, in the end...
That's going to be a blurb for the book, Righteous.
Well, you were talking about Fire's Journey and mm-hmm. how this is like a feminist epic, although, you know, the author was like, would never have anything of it.
Eunice Odio had no affection for feminism, I don't think, from what I've read of hers. And I've actually been in... pretty regular contact with her translator, Keith Eckes, for different reasons. But he gave me a lot of really great information about her.
But here we are with your book, and it's, you know, full of these poems too, or for these women. So we have to, you know, see this as some sort of maybe we don't have to see it this way, but there's got to be some, you know, when I say righteous, it's got the, you know, it's got the, maybe not like feminist protest type thing, but feminist celebration.
You know, I don't know. Is it feminist or is it just human? Do you know what I mean? No, like,
right, perfectly legitimate way to see it. And I mean, wasn't trying to push in a...
I'm not resisting it either. I'm just... I think it's because they did not have the opportunities that I have, you know, that I wanted to, you know, let this come into my life. Do you know what I mean?
No, I totally do. And I think it's awesome. And I mean, it's a great agenda to promote, right? As I said, you know, I've been reading poetry for decades, and these are authors, and a number of these authors are very new to me. So hooray. And there's
well,
a reason.
They were new to me too.
Right. And there's a reason for that. Right. And that's because their name wasn't William. Or she just used the one example. But you know what I'm saying? Obviously, it's clear. So Sharon, you've been living in Brooklyn for many years. And then with the pandemic, you have retreated to your getaway house in Pennsylvania.
We actually didn't. We were we did everything backwards. We were in Brooklyn till last July, which was when things kind of started getting better. But we were in Brooklyn during, you know, the whole thing. And the reason we came out here, it's such a romantic reason. David is working his job, and I'm working my jobs, and the cable connection is just better. I know, that's ridiculous.
Great anecdote.
It's true. Yeah. No, it's true. In Brooklyn, I can't even be on the internet in the front part of the house, in the front part of the apartment. I have to be in the kitchen. So, and here I can just be in this room and it's fine, you know. It's just really a little odd and strange. And I miss everybody.
Yeah. Well, you get, it sounds like you've been having a very productive period. And so perhaps the... you know, just getting out of the city is, you know, gives you a little more headspace or whatever you want to call it.
Most definitely. And I don't really get to see bears in the city. You know?
I bet you don't. Right?
No, I don't.
That would be something if it happened. Plus all the birds and whatnot.
Oh, the wildlife is great. And we did have a bear on the deck the other day.
Well, we're getting toward the end of the program. I know you had some. Have you read all the poems you wanted to read? Do you have another.
You want me to read a Flarf poem? Do you want me to read a recent Flarf poem?
How could I turn that down? That opportunity down? I wanted to remind listeners that we're listening to Sharon Mesmer on tonight's Poet Radio program. And, you know, when I introduced you earlier, I'd said you had a very nice website, but I didn't say that it's SharonMesmer.com. So if you're just getting introduced to Sharon's work here, there's a lot more out there. And
all you have to do is just, you know, Google it.
You said something about reading a Flarf poem.
Yes, I will read one of my quarantine poems.
Fantastic, Sharon. Great to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Chris. I mean, you know, even though we can't, like, be together in person, this was really lovely. Thank you.
I agree. Great focus time conversing, and it's great to hear poems.
Okay. This is sort of longish, but it's only one page, and it's a prose poem. It's called Adult Quarantine Friend. And actually, it appeared on Global Poemic, thanks to Betsy Andrews. Adult quarantine friend, the only thing keeping me alive in this cesspool of body panic and late-stage capitalism are your slam-dunk chips and dips. They make one-third of me feel Eastern European, the other like Toto, the band, not the dog, while my middle part is thrown totally off-kilter by memories of our massive horse foraging weekend. I will be going to great lengths to recreate snack feels as good as that. Tall, mature COVID companion, would you agree that the Republican love story is revealed in bacterial DNA while the Democrats is told by a stag beetle that lands on people? On election night 2016, I was that stag beetle waving my pincers in a pathetic attempt to communicate something to three old Italian women sitting on a bench outside a Brooklyn beauty salon and trying to kill me with their dirty pink slippers. Turns out I was right. Grown-ass pandemic pal, have you ever been rushed to the ER because you had a fish jaw stuck in your eyeball? How about a small plastic baby Jesus or your own earring? I'm asking for a friend. Because you have all your limbs and teeth, while I have a small plastic baby Jesus and an earring lodged in my eyeball and a massive fear of being around people. This begs the question, am I already suffering the rude incongruities of plague Christmas? Legal age, asymptomatic amigo, you are really into online gaming.